Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
If you're anything like me, and somebody tells you that they are offering a free online guide to Western civilization's great books, you say, "Awesome! I love Spider-Man!" Such a comment is usually followed by a disconcerting frown and a shake of the head on the part of the person who informed me about this intellectual offering. Admittedly, and this is akin to admitting a mortal intellectual sin if you're an academic, I do not actually enjoy reading Plato, Shakespeare, Dickens, and/or Swift. Perhaps this has to do with my freshman English literature class that was taught by a Freudian deconstructionist professor who thoroughly ruined any enjoyment that I ever received from fiction books. Or perhaps I am just too much of a dumb redneck to really understand what's going on in those books. Thus, it might come as a surprise to listeners that I regularly follow a weblog, or blog, written by a professor who is working his way through the canon of great books of Western civilization. Moreover, it should come as a shock that I was prompted by one of his recent posts to call him up and invite him on the show to discuss these books. That post, on the blog The Western Tradition, was entitled, "How the Great Books Can Help Christians Avoid Looking Uncharitable and Stupid," and was written by a previous guest on this podcast, Professor Jason Jewell. Jason is the chairman of the Department of Humanities at Faulkner University in Montgomery, Alabama, and he coordinates various other programs at Faulkner, including the Western Culture Heritage Course Sequence and the Faulkner Patristics Project at the V.P. Black School of Bible and Religion. He is also an adjunct scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. We most recently heard from Jason talking about John Locke's view of religious toleration on our show, an interview we will link to, as well as his fantastic blog, The Western Tradition. I strongly urge our listeners to visit his website because he provides a self-guided tour of the great books with commentary that helps make what he is reading relevant for our contemporary world. And I'm sure he would love for you to join in, so visit us and visit him. Jason, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me back on, Tony. It's a pleasure to be with you. Although I do have to say that I was shaking my head when you were talking about your reaction to the great books just now.
Ah, did you have a disconcerting frown?
Yes, I did.
It's just kind of automatic that everybody does that. So, you know, something I'll have to get over. Maybe you can school me on this today and convince me that the great books are indeed something I should be taking a look at once again.
I'll do my best.
All right. Well, one of the things that I really admire about your blog, The Western Tradition, and I do follow it regularly, even though it has to do with those books that I rarely ever read, is that you connect these books that are written in the distant past to our contemporary lives. And the post that you wrote that really caught my attention regarding how the great books can prevent Christians from looking uncharitable and stupid was prompted by an event that went viral on the interwebs. And actually, at first, I thought that you were writing that blog specifically aimed at me, but then I remember the Carly Simon song, "You're So Vain," and I thought, well, maybe not. But then I realized that you were probably aiming that post at me, not me specifically, but more kind of a general people like me. So go ahead and fill us in on that event that prompted you to write that blog post.
Okay, well, a couple of weeks ago, and you know, we're recording this in middle of February, so this has been early February, I believe, there was an incident in St. Louis at an Applebee's restaurant where a diner had refused to give a tip to the waitress who had served her at the during lunch, and she wrote on her receipt, after scratching out the suggested 18% tip amount, she wrote a little note on the receipt, "I give God 10%, why do you get 18%? Signed her name, and this person actually is a pastor at a church there in St. Louis. Well, the waitress, understandably, was a bit miffed by this treatment, and she scanned the receipt, a photograph of the receipt, posted it on the internet, and it went viral. And this is what you were talking about, how all suddenly everybody in in the United States seemingly was reading and commenting on this pastor who had treated this waitress poorly.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about this was a female pastor.
Yes, apparently so, and I did not include the name of the pastor in my blog post. I didn't think there was anything to be gained by that, but apparently, according to the news reports, it was a female pastor.
Yeah, you normally would think that male pastors would be, or men in general, just be a little more crass and nasty, and so there's a little bit of surprise there that it was from a female pastor. So what happens then?
Well, apparently the story gets worse in that when the pastor learned what had happened and that this photograph was all over the internet, she called up the restaurant to complain about the waitress, and the waitress got fired as a result of this.
Mm.
So the waitress ended up losing her job, and then, of course, in the blogosphere and in on the internet, the commentary about this turned even more negative towards the pastor, and then inevitably, by extension, this spilled over into a lot of commentary about Christianity in general, religion in general, and you had a lot of atheists and agnostics talking about, you know, how religion is useless and it doesn't help us behave morally and that sort of thing. And that's really what prompted me to take on this incident as a topic of a blog post.
Yeah, and it is titled very well because it did open the door to all these critiques of hypocrisy, of being uncharitable, and just being downright stupid. But you connected it better than any of the other comments that I saw to a book by Plato called It's a Plato book. What's the Plato book?
It's called Euthydemus.
Euthydemus. See, I thought that was an English New Wave band from the 1980s.
See, well, it could be. I wouldn't know.
Okay. Now, Euthydemus. Euthydemus. Those Greeks should have written in plain English so I could understand it better. Anyways, all right, Euthydemus. So I'm guessing not many people in my listening audience are familiar with Euthydemus, but maybe they are. We got a pretty smart listening audience out there. So give me the lowdown on how Plato, writing several thousand years ago, could have helped Pastor Dum-Dum from making a fool of herself.
Okay, yeah, and Euthydemus is one of Plato's dialogues. Of course, Plato wrote many of those, and Euthydemus is one of the, I would say, probably one of the less familiar ones. It's not one that's normally assigned to students either in high school or in college or even in graduate school, for that matter. So it's not one that you would just run across in the normal course of an educational curriculum. But it did have a direct bearing on this, and I had just read it recently as part of my own Great Books project. So basically the situation in this dialogue is that Socrates, who is a major character, the star of most of Plato's dialogues, is telling a story about these two teachers of philosophy, the two sophists, who are going around in Athens and basically hiring themselves out, you know, offering to make people really smart and to teach them how to argue and win arguments for a fee. And Socrates talks about the conversation that he had with these people. And he recounts the discussion, and these two sophists are really confusing the people that they're speaking to. They got this big crowd of listeners around them, and one of the people in the crowd says, okay, I'll argue with you, I'll take you on. And then these two guys essentially run circles around the poor dupe by confusing him and using what's known as the fallacy of equivocation, which happens to be the same fallacy that was on display here with this pastor who wrote the note on the receipt at Applebee's. So that's where I made the connection that the same logical fallacy was at play in both instances.
Okay, explain that fallacy of equivocation and connect it to both ancient Greece and to modern-day Applebee's.
Okay, equivocation is when you are making an argument or a statement and you use a term in one way with one definition, and then later on, it could be in the same sentence, it could be a couple of sentences later, a later paragraph, but later on, at some point in the argument, you use the word again, but the definition has shifted. Now, we know there are a lot of words out there that have more than one definition or can be understood in more than one sense. And so if you start an argument using a term in one sense, but then you shift that definition or that meaning to something else as part of the same argument, you are equivocating. You are eventually going to come to a conclusion that's not justified on the basis of the shifting definition of your term.
Okay, so this pastor at Applebee's, on the receipt from her diner bill, wrote only about, I don't know, 10, 12 words. How did she equivocate in that short of period of time?
Yeah, that's a good question. And as I said, equivocation can happen in a very short space of time. The note that the pastor wrote was, I give God 10%, why do you get 18%? And the equivocation there is on the meaning of that word percent.
Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about here? And as I mentioned in the post, when you use a word like percent, it becomes meaningless unless you have a context for that word. 10% of what are we talking about? 18% of what? And in this case, what the pastor apparently was doing was referring to, when she says, I give God 10%, she's talking about the Christian tithe.
Mm-hmm.
That presumably she gives God, gives to the church, 10% of her income. So that's a tradition in the church that, you know, most Christians are taught to respect and to try to do to the best of their ability. Of course, not all Christians do that, but it is one of those time-honored traditions of in the church. And then she moves on to say, why do you get 18%? Well, the equivocation comes because we're not talking about 18% of the same thing. We're not talking about 18% of the pastor's income. We're talking about 18% of the amount of the check, which in this case, I think the lunch check was somewhere between $30 and $40. So the 18% of that check was something like $6. So by saying, why do you get 18%? Of course, what the pastor is doing there is making it look like by giving the waitress 18% of this check, she's being more generous towards the waitress than she is by giving 10% of her income to the church.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that's comparing apples and oranges. We're not talking about percentages of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the 18% of the lunch check, the $6 or whatever, of course, that's just a tiny fraction of 1% of what this pastor likely makes in a year. So this is nothing in comparison to the amount of money that presumably she gives to the church as part of her tithe.
Okay. So I can see how that, yeah, how that shifts the percentage. Actually, I'm kind of surprised that Applebee's recommends 18%. I always thought it was 15%. I got to be a little bit more careful at Applebee's from now on. So
yeah, you know, I don't begrudge any waiter or waitress any tip that they receive. I know that, you know, their base wage is very low and they rely on that a lot. But yeah, you know, I've wondered about that too over the years. I remember when I was younger that 10% was considered a good tip, and now it's up to 15 or 18, or in some cases 20. So
yeah.
I've never really understood why that has happened along the way. But again, you know, $6 is not a lot of money, no matter how you slice and dice
yeah.
it. But
and mm-hmm, go ahead.
But what this pastor was doing was trying to make it look as though 18% would be an unjustified, extravagant tip to provide to this poor waitress, who, you know, who knows how much she had run around that time during that lunch, and how many tables she had to wait on, and how much stress she had to undergo. I mean, I doubt that $6, in any reasonable person would look at that and say $6 is just some crazy amount of money to tip this person.
Right, and it certainly made the pastor look very uncharitable and stupid, as you mentioned, as well as everybody on the internet mentioned. And when you wrote that blog post, you got a number of comments there, and one of the comments you received on this post was from someone who calls himself Preston, and I quote, but surely all we need to read is the Bible, which we then will interpret ourselves without having any knowledge of the history or culture it came out of. How could this go wrong? Unquote. Now this was obviously a bit of satire and sarcasm on the part of Preston, who appears to be lampooning many of the Christians who say we only need one great book, and that is the Bible. And I should note, by the way, that last week we did have a podcast on satire and how it is used for social reform. So, Preston, if you are listening, you get an A+ for applying last week's podcast. But this brings us to the bigger question of how the great books can actually help Christians. Had that pastor at Applebee's read Euthydemus well before, or maybe just a week before she went to Applebee's, maybe this whole thing would have been averted. So that's the thing I want to talk about here, is that how can us Christians, or I would say any religious folks in general, can benefit from reading the great books in Western civilization in such a way that it, helps inform our reading of scriptures or other great sacred books. So let's first start by defining that term, great book. What makes for a great book, and who gets to decide what is great and what is not so great?
Okay, and before I answer that question, let me just point out that Preston, who commented on the blog, is one of my former students.
Oh.
And so he obviously knew that I would take his comment in the spirit in which it was intended, that he was really agreeing with the spirit of the post. But to move on to the definition of a great book, this is a term or a phrase that's been in use for, I would say, probably about 75 to 100 years. It came into use in the 20th century as a way of describing certain kinds of works. They could be works of literature, like novels, or they could be poems, whether they're epic poems and very long poems like Homer's Odyssey, or they could be shorter poems. They could be works of history. They could be works of science. They could be works of philosophy or theology or mathematics. There's a lot of different kinds of books that could be designated as a great book. And what the people who coined this phrase intended to convey by that is that this is a book that never goes out of style. This is a book that is timeless, that it's always relevant. So you can always gain something from it, and the reason why you can always gain something from it, even if the book was written thousands of years ago, as in the case of this Platonic dialogue Euthydemus, is that the book deals with what we call in academia universals. These are ideas or concepts that are always relevant to human beings, no matter what time they're living in, no matter what society they're a part of. There are certain things that are universal to human beings that these books deal with, and there are insights about those universals contained in these books that we can read and contemplate and maybe gain something from. Once we try to figure out, what is the author saying, and we can try to weigh, is this author right? And if we decide the author's right, we can try to apply that knowledge somehow, as in the case of this example of the pastor. If she had known what the fallacy of equivocation was, and she was paying attention to that sort of thing in her own thinking, she probably would not have made this elementary mistake of confusing what these percentages were that she put on this receipt. So a great book, then, again, is something that is deals with a universal. An example of that would be, what is beauty? Okay, different cultures and different people at different times have had different ideas of what constitutes beauty, what kind of people are beautiful and what kind of people aren't. And if you go from culture to culture, of course, you see the people who are considered beautiful might look very different, depending on what kind of culture you're looking in. Or if you go back over time and you see paintings from earlier centuries about some woman who is considered beautiful at that time, you might look at that and say, she doesn't look that great to me. But, maybe at that time they thought differently. But the point is, no matter what society you're looking at, even if their precise understanding of beauty is maybe different from ours, they still have an idea of beauty. They have an idea of what beauty is, and there are writers and thinkers in those cultures who talk about beauty and what we should be looking for in trying to label something as being beautiful or ugly. And that's something that we can, in the 21st century, think about and try to reflect on and try to come to some kind of application.
Now, in our email exchange, when I was trying to get you to do this podcast, which you graciously have accepted, you mentioned that a great book is not just what people would consider literature. So what is the difference between great book and literature?
Okay, well, what most people think of as literature, in the modern world at least, is a work of imagination. This could be a poem, you know, kind of an Emily Dickinson type, "How Do I Love Thee," "Let Me Count the Ways" sort of thing. That's a work of imagination, expression of emotion, or a work of fiction is a work of literature. We have a short story is a work of literature in the modern sense, some kind of work of imagination that's not talking about specific events necessarily in the real world or real people, but it's intended to get us to use our imagination to come to some kind of truth or understanding about the world that we live in, even though it's not talking about maybe necessarily real people or real places or real events.
Okay. Can you give me some well-known examples that might span the course of history of what constitutes a great book as compared to, say, a work of literature? Especially, I mean, you started out earlier mentioning Homer and Homer's Odyssey, and that is one of the first books I ever read as a freshman in college in my English lit class. And I have to admit, I love that book. It read like a comic book for me. And it told stories of heroism and courage. And, you know, I was like, wow, I love this stuff. But I had one of these Freudian deconstructionist professors that was reading so much into it. And I'd look at this thing, I said, I'm totally missing the boat on this. But so Homer's The Odyssey is one of those books. What other books would constitute the canon of great books in Western Civ?
Well, if we're talking about this category of imaginative literature, there are usually five great epic poems that are usually thrown out there as great examples. Two of them are by Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey. Another would be Virgil's Aeneid. That's another poem from ancient Rome. Dante's Divine Comedy from the Middle Ages. And then John Milton's Paradise Lost would be a Renaissance work, a 17th century work. Those are all examples of imaginative literature. Other, if you come over to the genre of the novel, something like Don Quixote or perhaps a novel by Charles Dickens or Melville's Moby Dick would be considered a great work. If we move outside of this genre of literature to some other fields, in the example of history, for example, the ancient Greek historian Herodotus, the histories of Herodotus, is considered to be a great work. A lot of people call Herodotus the father of history for really pioneering that style of writing. Other great historians through the centuries have been, for example, the Roman historian Tacitus, who told us about the Emperor Nero and all the crazy things that he did, or Gibbon, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which most people have heard of. He's an 18th century historian, a representative of the Enlightenment. Other genres in the area of philosophy, of course, we've got the Dialogues of Plato, which we've already mentioned, the works of Plato's student Aristotle. Coming up into more modern times, we've got, for example, the writings of John Calvin, The Institutes of the Christian Religion. That's considered a great book. A work of theology that even non-Christians have recognized the achievement that Calvin had in putting together this systematic presentation of Christian doctrine. Even, you know, of course, a lot of Christians don't agree with everything that Calvin wrote, but still, it's almost nobody denies that it is a great work in the sense of that it's dealing with these really important issues, these universal concerns of human beings. The works of St. Augustine. Going back a little earlier, the Confessions of St. Augustine or the City of God and other great works of theology are considered great books, even by those who are not Christians. So we have a mixture of, in the canon of the great books, we have a mixture of works by pre-Christian authors, classical pagans. We've got works by great Christian authors through the centuries, and we have also people who are hostile to Christianity, people who attacked Christianity in various forms, like Friedrich Nietzsche, for example, the philosopher of the late 19th century, who's been very influential. So we've got, and then I should also mention maybe at least one or two of the scientific works. Nicholas Copernicus, his treatise in which he put forward the heliocentric theory of the solar system, the idea that the Earth goes around the sun, you know, that's considered to be a great work. That changed the way a lot of people think about the universe that we live in. Or the ancient mathematician Euclid, his Elements of Geometry. You know, this was a textbook of geometry that was used up until the 19th or 20th centuries in some areas. So I know most people go through a geometry class at some point when they're in the 9th or 10th grade, and what you were learning there was Euclidean geometry. It's basically the same ideas that Euclid first put forward there in the 3rd century B.C. So there's a lot of different kinds of books that are considered to be part of this canon of the great books.
Now, a lot of the books that you mentioned there, I have already heard of. In fact, I think all of them. So I'm patting myself on the back now for not being that dumb. But are there some books that are in that canon that might be a little bit less well known?
Yes, I mean, I'd say so. Let me try to think here. A lot of the plays of the ancient Greek playwrights, I mean, some people are familiar with the authors such as Aeschylus or Sophocles, but I would imagine that a lot of their plays might not be very familiar to most people. So, for example, the playwright Aeschylus, he wrote some very well-known plays that trace the family of Agamemnon, one of the heroes of the Trojan War, who comes home and then is murdered by his wife and her lover. That's one of the really well-known plays by Aeschylus. But then he wrote others like Prometheus Bound and others that aren't quite so familiar to most people today. Coming up into the more modern age, unless you were really paying close attention in your English literature class, in
which I wasn't,
you may not recognize the name Henry Fielding, who wrote a novel called Tom Jones, which was written in the 18th century, was really influential in the formation of the genre of the novel. It's considered a great book. A lot of people today have never heard of it.
Yeah, that's not the book that sings "What's New, Pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa," is it?
No, this is a different Tom Jones.
Oh, okay,
he does have a kind of a comic flair or streak in him as well.
Okay, let me ask about this. You know, some of the lesser known ones. That's somewhat an unfair question because it's difficult to know some of these. But how does a book get onto the canon? And I guess part of this is, you know, who decides what constitutes a great book? Is there some sort of time lag that has to go on before one gets on there? Or has there been a book that has come out, let's say, in the past 30, 40 years that has made it into that canon?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'll answer it in two ways. First of all, you're right in saying that who gets to decide this? I mean, that's a big question, and it is problematic. A lot of people out there, a lot of academics, like your freshman literature professor, probably would have even denied that there was such a thing as a great book.
Yeah.
There are people out there, the deconstructionists, some of them would make extreme kinds of statements, who maybe even going to the extent of saying something like a laundry list is just as much literature as a Shakespeare play. And that, you know, if we designate one work as great and another work as not great, then we're being arbitrary and we're playing favorites and those kinds of things. And they would argue that perhaps that when a work gets designated as great, it's because its backers had some kind of political clout or something like that. And there are some authors, both Christian authors and non-Christian authors, who in more recent years who still like this idea of having great books and the classics. They've moved sort of away from that notion of canon, which implies that there are certain works that everybody must read if you want to be educated, and more to the idea of what is a classic, something that does have this kind of timeless quality. But another way to answer the question then is there a time lag? I would say yes, there is. And I would say that probably at a minimum, a couple of generations would need to go by before, you know, to see if a book or a work stands the test of time. Are people still going back to it and revisiting it and learning things from it once it's removed from the immediate time and place in which the work was composed? And this is one reason why when Mortimer Adler, he was the big champion of the great books concept in the mid to late 20th century, when he put together those big 50, 60 volume compilations of the great books of the Western world, he said very explicitly, we're not going to include anything in this series that's not at least 50 years old. If it's not at least 50 years old, the jury is still out on whether this is a great work or not. And so he did recognize that to know whether something has that timeless quality, you have to give it several decades at a minimum to get it out of that immediate context of the time and place in which it was composed.
Okay. So, in terms of, and I'm just running through this laundry list myself of books that I would associate with that canon, it would seem that the most recent great books might have been something like Mark Twain or something like The Great Gatsby or something like that. Is that where we are now in the timeline, or have we reached something in the mid-20th century?
Yeah, I would say, and this is not, the last, Adler's last edition of the great books was published in 1990, and he had some things from the 20s and 30s in there. Mm-hmm. George Orwell's Animal Farm, which I think mm-hmm. is from the 40s, was in there. Mm-hmm. I would say that we might be to the point now where we could start to consider for designation as a great book some works like Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, for example. That was originally published in the 50s, but people are still going back to it. It's at least as popular as it has ever been. Maybe some of C.S. Lewis's writings. Lewis is extremely popular, both with obviously with Christians, but also with a lot of non-Christian authors. Adaptations of the Screwtape Letters play very well with non-Christian audiences, and so this is something that does have a certain universal appeal to people. And even generations after Lewis and Tolkien's deaths, people are still going back to them and reading them and learning from them and applying their insights. So I think authors like that could be candidates for inclusion in this, whatever you want to call it, a canon or the body of great literature, what have you. I think we're to the point where those guys from maybe the 50s and the early 60s perhaps could be considered.
Now, I have to mention here that a few months back we had one of your colleagues and friends, Corey Olson, talking about J.R.R. Tolkien. So, I I'm patting myself on the back saying, hey, I might be on this great books thing after all. I don't know. Now, here's something that I want to talk to you about, and this gets to you in a little bit personal sense. You've been doing something pretty amazing on your own blog. Rather than just posting your witty and or angry comments about the news like every other blogger in the world seems to do, you actually set before yourself a challenge to read a pantheon of these great books over the course of several years. I think it was 3, 4, 5 years or so that you've been engaging in this project. And along the way, you're providing brief commentary on what you're reading, spliced in with current events, like this thing from Applebee's, that appear, things that might appear on the nightly news, but also things that appear in your daily life, such as plumbing problems or whatever it might be. How did all of this stuff get started? Where did you come up with this idea, and how has it progressed?
Okay, well, yeah, it is a 7-year project that I'm currently in the third year of working on. I'm very, I don't want to jinx myself, but I am very happy that I've been able to keep it consistently going for this long. The genesis of the project was coming from a couple of things. I had, for several years here at Faulkner, I've been teaching courses to undergraduates and graduate students that are based on the great books. And I had recognized years ago that I did have something of a deficiency in certain areas because my academic background was not really in literature at all. I didn't come to the study of literature until I was a graduate student, and my training has all been as a historian. So I was very familiar with a lot of the, for example, if you look at the body of great books, I was very familiar with a lot of the historians and economists. I'm sure you're familiar with Adam Smith, Tony. He's one of the authors in the Great Books series.
Yep. No, that's the one area that I link with. I do very well with the English and Scottish Enlightenment in that period of time, as well as the Austrian School of Economics that you're interested in as well, von Mises and Hayek and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a very good familiarity with a good portion of that. But then when it came to some of the philosophy, for example, some of the imaginative literature, I would look at the list of the books and say, oh, yeah, I recognize those authors. I recognize the titles of those works, but I have never read a lot of them. And I knew that, you know, for me to be the best professor that I could be, it would really be beneficial for me to try to systematically read through all those works. And then also, you know, just the understanding from the limited exposure I had had to the great books corpus, you know, I knew that the more that you come into contact with these works and the more you sort of chew on them and digest them and try to figure out the ideas that they contain, it really does change your perspective on the world around you. It gives you insights into things like what we've been discussing with the recent Applebee's brouhaha. You know, it gives you a certain perspective on those things that a lot of people in our society don't have. But if they were to stop and think about it and were guided in a certain way, they would say, oh, yes, yeah, I understand why that was a silly thing for that person to do, or I understand why it was a great decision for this political leader to do such and such, or a terrible decision, or what have you. So I knew that it would make me a more reflective person and more give me a better understanding of what was going on in the world around me. And I think that you touched on this earlier, that this is one of the things that turns a lot of people off to the great books, is that they don't see the immediate practical relevance of it. They say, well, how's that going to help me, you know, get a raise at my job? How's that going to help me, you know, make my mortgage payment next month or something like that? And so they dismiss the study of literature without necessarily taking into account some of these long-term benefits of when you become immersed in this body of work. So I had a lot of those thoughts running through my head, and then I read a really great book on goal setting, and near the end of 2010, I said, okay, doggone it, I'm going to set this as a goal. I'm going to give myself 7 years. I'm going to read through this body of literature, which amounts to about 40,000 pages. small font, double column.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it in Old English and all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so I knew it was a big task I was taking on. But I figured, you know, if I were systematic about it and deliberate, you know, I could break it down to a little more than 100 pages a week, and I thought that was manageable. I could spend a few hours a week on it. And so far, I've been able to hold to that. And it really has been great for my own professional development and for my own awareness of the world as a citizen and as a Christian as well, to be able to, you know, have that, the kind of understanding, and maybe not even so much understanding all the answers to every question, but to understanding that there are, I mean, it helps you to learn what questions should you be asking of the world. A lot of people never get to the right answers because they don't know which questions to ask.
Yeah, yeah.
And study of the great books really helps you to figure out what the right questions are.
Well, one of the interesting things that you do on that blog is to read different books. So you're not just reading one at a time. It's not a big stack and you take from the top of the stack, but you're reading several books in conjunction with one another, and it's not diachronic either. I mean, you're a historian. I figured, well, you start at day one and you end at, you know, at the end, but you're reading books like Herman Melville in conjunction with maybe an Aristotle or, you know, a Milton or somebody like that. And how do you choose what you're going to read, when you're going to read?
Originally, my thinking was I would try to start with works that were generally considered to be not quite as difficult and work my way up to the more difficult works. So I wasn't going to pull out Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason and try to read that the first week. I knew that would be death to my motivation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
and so, for one thing, I was trying to start relatively easy and work my way up to more difficult things. But then also, as you said, I try to spread myself out across different genres every week, because again, I knew that if I were simply to say I'm going to read 100 pages a week, and this week I'm going to sit down and read 100 pages of some mathematician and full of geometrical proofs, and I'm not a mathematician, and I mean, I might have made an A in geometry in the ninth grade, but that doesn't mean that
right.
You know, I'm ready to tackle all of this stuff. I knew that it would be a lot easier to keep my motivation going if I were reading shorter sections of several different works each week. So for example, right now I'm in the middle of five different long works as part of the program. But sort of the unanticipated benefit of that is, as you said, when you do this, you immediately begin to see connections between the different authors that you're reading, because particularly the authors who come later chronologically, you know, they're all looking back at the same body of work that you're also reading at the same time. So just this past week, I think I was reading a little section from St. Thomas Aquinas, from his Summa Theologica, and it really jumped out at me off the page how he was doing the same kind of thing in this particular section that Aristotle had done in a work that I had just read the previous week. And I mean, if you know anything about Thomas Aquinas, you know that he's very indebted to Aristotle in a lot of what he does. But right. But to see those two things basically side by side, I mean, it really brings that home, and you can... And then also, one thing that I often do is if I'm reading a short story from the 20th century and there's some kind of reference to a great author of the past, I'll point that out and say, see, all these authors, it's all connected. It's all one big body of knowledge that... We're basically taking off a mouthful at a time as we try to read through this.
Yeah, and I have to admit, I'm following along with you without doing the reading, so I'm reading the great books vicariously through you and getting advice on childcare and other things as I go along, which is neat because you are making this available to the public, and I'm wondering how that has connected with individuals. Obviously, Preston is following you. Preston, you out there. And Have you picked up other people that are reading along with you that, you get comments every so often there on your blog with people with different insights? Some of the posts have very long comments and really provoke a lot of discussion. Other ones are, like any blog, it's, people read through it quick. And how is it connected with the broader audience that you've been trying to reach?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Not surprisingly, when I first announced on the blog that I was going to do this project, and I started off the first few weeks, I had quite a number of people who said, oh, this is a great idea, I want to do this, and they're posting regular comments on what I'm doing, all that, and then one by one they kind of drop off, because it really is a serious commitment of time and energy to try to read through, to devote 7 years to reading through this big body of work, which is why, and I don't fault anybody for not sticking through with the whole thing. I'm not, casting thunderbolts from my mountaintop saying you're not good enough because you're not reading this as much as I am. But I encourage people on the blog to say, even if you can't do a whole lot of this sort of reading, anything is better than nothing. So if all you can do is read one essay or read a short story or read a little bit of a novel here or there and then come and post something about it, please say, I welcome that kind of participation. Anything is better than nothing when you're part of this journey, so I just try to encourage people to do that as much as I can. And I have had quite a few people, as you know, come in and say, oh, yeah, this particular work, I've always been struck by this thing. And it's helpful to me as well, because I get different people's perspectives and insights on certain parts of the text that I didn't catch the first time I went through it. And that's another thing about what's usually considered to be part of the definition of a great book, is that, I should have mentioned this earlier, but it's a book that bears rereading. You can go back and read it a second or a third or a fourth time and get new insights from it every time you go back to it. That's a part of the definition of what helps a book to stand the test of time. So I've had a lot of good interaction. As already noted, some of these are with people who are my students, either current or former students at the university. Others are people whom I've simply met through the blog and have been great at offering comments and observations about the works. And I've talked to other people who have said, oh, yes, I went through a kind of great books reading of my own several years ago. I might not have read everything that you're reading, but I did read this, this, and this, and that was great for me. And it's been really enriching to know that there are other people out there who see the value of this. And I don't know that I've ever met anybody who didn't see any value in what I'm doing. Everybody on some level recognizes, I know that book's out there, and I know that it would probably be good for me to read it at some point, but then there's an opportunity cost question, right? There's always something else that seems more pressing or more urgent.
Oh, yeah.
Or something, or a football game to watch or something. So, everybody has their own priorities, but I've never really encountered anybody who would just flat out say, that's pointless what you're doing.
Yeah, no, and that's how I've interacted with your blog. I check on it on a regular basis, and you have the snippets of what you've read, and there was a a couple months ago, maybe a year ago, that you were dipping your toes into Austrian economics a little bit. And it prompted me to look over my desk chair and say, oh, wait a minute, I got some of these books on my shelf and they're a little bit dusty and I haven't read them in a while. And actually, what you've been doing has prompted me to offer a new seminar course I'm going to do next year on classical liberal economics and the Austrian school as well. So you're having an effect wide and varied out there in the world. Now, we are.
Will I get credit in the syllabus, Tony?
Sure, I will give you credit in the syllabus.
Right. So that's all I want. Link to my blog, and
we will do that. Yeah, and get connected with that von Mises Institute too. So we're a podcast that, or an audio blog, I guess. So we're doing the same thing as you are. We're trying to bring classic works as well as not so classic works to our attention of our readers, and. But we're one that focuses specifically on religion, and I want to get back to that point here because your post from a few weeks ago regarding the pastor at Applebee's was generally about why Christians need to read the Great Book, or religious folks in general, I think we could generalize it to. Now, we've already discussed ways that we can avoid equivocation in trying to tie biblical premises to arguments where they really don't apply, like for the double chocolate cheesecake at Applebee's. But are there any other important themes that these great books can help Christians or other religious believers better understand their faith?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't say that, and we're not, even for those of us who are Christians and love the great books, we don't put the great books up, on the same level or the same tier as Scripture or anything like that. We recognize that the Bible is a unique work, and Christians should pay more attention to the Bible than they should to any other book out there. And I know that there are differences of emphasis between Protestant traditions and Catholic traditions and Orthodox. I mean, they all look at the Scriptures in slightly different ways. One thing that I run into occasionally from people who are from a generically Protestant background is essentially what Preston on the blog was saying, kind of tongue-in-cheek, as long as we read the Bible, we're fine. And, why should we need anything else? And they'll quote a couple of passages from the Bible that seem to lend weight to that opinion. And my response to that is, yes, the Bible might be the only book that you need to pay attention if the question is salvation. Okay, now Christians are concerned with salvation. We're all interested in that. And the Bible is really the only book that's going to help you, to get there. But the Christian life and the Christian walk and its life on this earth in general is more about, it's more than just making sure that you go to heaven when you die. There are many other things that we're called to do as part of this this walk that we go through. And here is where the great books can really help Christians in that walk. Now, In some cases, the Christian authors of great books can help you explicitly with your faith. I mean, understanding God better. I mean, I would not hesitate to recommend the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas or St. Augustine or any of the other Christian authors, John Calvin, to anybody who professes faith in Christ and is wanting to come to a deeper and richer understanding of the Christian faith. I mean, those authors are definitely going to help you do that, even if you wind up not agreeing with many of the things that they say, still they will prompt you to be very reflective and ask serious questions about the nature of your faith and what you can count on as true and how to apply that. Mm-hmm. Now, you move beyond those explicitly Christian authors into kind of the broader world of the great books, and sometimes even those can help you explicitly in your faith, because let's say, for example, you want to have the strongest faith you can. One of the things that you need to do is to seriously consider arguments against the Christian faith. If you want to be the best Christian you can be, you need to know how to answer criticisms of Christianity. I believe it's in the Apostle Peter in one of his epistles says, be always ready to give to give an answer when someone questions you about your faith. And I think that could be applied to the idea that Christians should be familiar with the major arguments against their faith and have a response to those. And that response, I mean, in my opinion at least, needs to go beyond simply saying, you know, Jesus came into my heart and I have this feeling that I've experienced Jesus and therefore I know that Christianity is true. Well, that might be satisfactory to you, but that is not an evangelistic tool necessarily in my words. I mean, it's not going to persuade anyone who has not had that same experience. So we need to be able to work from common ground with people who are questioning. And that means, in my opinion, to be conversant with a lot of the criticisms of Christianity that come out of either classical paganism or the Enlightenment or from modernism. And a lot of those authors are represented in the great books. Authors like Voltaire, the 18th century philosopher who was very critical of Christianity. Christians need to be able to answer his criticisms. When Voltaire says, okay, we had this big earthquake in Lisbon in 1755 and it killed this many people, you know, tens of thousands of people, how could a good God let that happen? And Christians need to have an answer to that. Christians need to have an answer to Friedrich Nietzsche, who says, who to his credit is one of the most consistent anti-Christian thinkers, who says we need to discard not only Christian doctrine, but the entire system of Christian idea of right and wrong and good and evil and all that sort of thing and construct a whole new morality. Christians need to be able to answer those kinds of arguments. So those authors are represented in the great books, and Christians, I think, have an intellectual obligation to be able to meet those arguments head on.
Mm-hmm.
Getting beyond that, simply just saying for what is the Christian faith and is it true or false and those sorts of things, all Christians agree that you know, we need to be developing certain habits, certain virtues in our lives. And, of course, the Bible is very helpful for us in doing that. But there, you know, the Bible is not a textbook of everything. The Bible is not a textbook of logic. The Bible is not a textbook of economics. I mean, certainly there are things in the Bible that bear on those things and that relate to them and that we should allow ourselves to be disciplined by in our minds, I would submit. But if it's useful for a Christian to think logically, to have his thoughts in good order, and to make sure that his conclusions are logical, you know, from the ideas that he has, the Bible isn't going to give you a step-by-step procedure on how to do that. You need to go somewhere else to get that information. And the great books is a great place to do that. If you read through, for example, the works of Aristotle on logic, they're tough to understand. They might be a hard set of works to get through, but if you wrestle with them and you come out the other side, you're going to be a much more logical thinker than you were before you went in, and that's going to help you in your Christian walk. It's going to help you to avoid writing silly things on Applebee's receipts and making yourself look foolish,
right,
and to give the church a bad name by extension. So Christians all agree that there are certain virtues, and you know, traditionally we have these seven virtues in the history of the church. You know, there's prudence and fortitude and justice and faith, hope, and love. You know, we got all these virtues that many of the classical authors and other non-Christian authors in the great books tradition wrote very eloquently and movingly about these virtues. They saw them as being necessary as well, and they said great things, wrote great things on how people can achieve those virtues. And the Christian perspective on these pagan writers and non-Christian writers historically has been all truth is God's truth. It doesn't matter if a Christian said it or if a non-Christian said it. If it's true, that's something that God gave us. That's something that God has revealed through the creation, through the natural gifts that he bestowed on people in their own minds. And if the Stoic philosopher Epictetus gave us some great ideas on how to practice self-control, which is something that we're told as Christians we need to develop, let's go to Epictetus. Let's see what he has to say. Let's put some of his ideas into practice. That's something that, you know, throughout the centuries, Christians, for example, have looked at those Stoic philosophers and said, there's a lot of great stuff here. We don't agree with a lot that's in the Stoic philosophy, but when it comes to practical application of some of these things, they said these guys are almost Christian in the way that they express a lot of these views. so Christians can get a lot from that tradition of going to the great books and looking to see how these authors have made recommendations in these various areas and put those into work in our own lives. We can take, there's that old metaphor that we use in the church of plundering the Egyptians, right? When the Israelites left Egypt, they had borrowed all the gold and silver jewelry from their Egyptian acquaintances, and they took it out of Egypt with them, and that was considered a legitimate thing. Here was the wealth of Egypt that the Israelites carried out with them. And in Christian history, the church has said the same thing. All truth is God's truth, and we can go to a pagan author and take that insight, take that work, and take it for Christ, redeem it for the church and put it into practice, and that helps in the work of the kingdom of God.
As you were talking about this, I was thinking about a podcast that we did a couple months ago with Art Carden, who talked about issues of Christian charity and connecting it with some of the classical liberal economists such as Smith and Ricardo, as well as some of the folks in the Austrian school. So I'm point folks back to that one, because that's another example of how the classics have been used to inform some of our ideas of a specific Christian virtue, that of Christian charity. But I want to bring this broader as we come to the close of our podcast. One of the things that you're doing with your blog, but also at Faulkner University, is really to revitalize the study of these great books on college campuses. And I consider this to be a very noble cause, even though I'm a hard sell on some of these great books. But especially considering what you said about the importance of these books. But here's the thing, is that we're talking about revitalizing the great books. And one has to wonder why we're doing the revitalizing. What has been happening to our study of the great books in academia over the past several decades? Has it been deteriorating? Are there any bright spots that we might be resurrecting or revitalizing some of the study?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tony. And there's a somewhat complicated history going back about 100 years or so, in which a lot of the intellectuals and the educational establishment has made a self-conscious effort to move away from the great books, or whether you want to call it the great tradition or the great conversation. There was a sense, going back to progressive educators of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, John Dewey's a good example of this, the idea that this emphasis on the great tradition in educational curriculum is tying us down, it's shackling us to the past, and we need to enter the brave new world of modernity and get rid of all of these classical and Christian, all this baggage that we've been carrying around with us for 2,000 years, and just move into this new era where we can, through the wonders of education, remake human nature and have a wonderful and idyllic society. Well, looking back over the last 100 years, I think the verdict is in that was the wrong way to go. That the rejection of the classics, the rejection of the Christian tradition in education, did not bring about all of the promised benefits that these people thought. I'm thinking, for example, some of the 19th century advocates of public education and secularizing education, who promised that you just give us the kids and let us educate them properly, and in 20 years the jails will be empty. And that kind of rhetoric was employed quite a bit in the 19th century, and obviously that was at odds with the Christian notion of the sinful nature of humanity and the various problems that are just part of the human condition. And the function of the great books and the great tradition through the centuries has been in large part to restrain those negative tendencies that we have in us as part of being human, as part of our sinfulness. So there has been an effort in certain quarters, starting in the middle of the 20th century, and then I think accelerating in the last 30 years or so, particularly among Christian schools, but also in certain secular schools, to bring back this great tradition, to bring back the great books, and to reconnect the people of today, whether they're students in K-12 institutions or colleges or adult learners who are reading on their own, to reconnect them with the wisdom of our civilization's traditions and the greatest works that our civilization has produced, to bring them back into conversation with that. One of the great benefits Now, everyone talks today about the problem we have in our society between the sort of generational warfare, that the youth are always in rebellion, and the youth don't understand their parents, and the parents don't understand their kids, and we have a distinctive youth culture out there where the kids do their own thing, and the parents and grandparents don't get it, and the parents don't understand the grandparents, and there's this, it seems like there's this big break between the generations that has political consequences, what's going to happen to Social Security, all those kinds of real world questions that confront us in the 21st century. And one of the great benefits of, one of the problems that has led to the situation where we are today, where the generations don't know how to talk to each other, is that they don't speak the same language. They were not educated the same way. They didn't read the same stuff when they went through school. One of the big benefits of the great tradition, the great books, is that if this is part of an educational curriculum, then the generations, parent to child to grandparent, they would have that continuity. They would know. They would have had exposure to the same things along the way, and they would have the same vocabulary to work with when they're trying to address the various problems that they are working with. Instead of saying, hey, 2,000 years ago there was this guy named Plato, and he wrote this thing named Euthydemus, and there were these two guys in the dialogue, and they did this. And instead of having to preface your point with all that explanation, you could just say to someone, oh, the situation you're in right now, that's just like what happened in Euthydemus. Oh, I get it. It really, having that common vocabulary really facilitates exchange of ideas. And it would be like you sitting down with somebody who had never seen a football game and trying to show them what a great game this was, but you don't have a common vocabulary to work with.
Right.
They don't know the terminology of downs and yards and all that sort of thing. So one of the big arguments for reviving the great books in education is to reconnect the generations with each other. And that's on top of the point that we've already been discussing about how the great books can have these practical instrumental effects in the lives of individuals by helping them to develop virtue and to explore, for Christians, to explore the Christian faith more fully.
Yeah, one of the areas that you didn't mention, and I was thinking as you were talking about where this revitalization is starting to occur, you mentioned among Christian college campuses as well as K-12 schools and even in some of the secular institutions, but one that we neglected to mention as well is homeschooling, which there's been
Absolutely.
A great deal of classical education homeschooling that is out there. And I have often found that the college students that I teach who have been homeschooled really do connect with this. I mean, they're light years ahead of other students in connecting with some of the great books, or at least the great concepts, because I'm one of those folks who doesn't connect very well with the great books, because I'm a pretty hard sell on this, which brings me to the last question here. And this is a hardball question. And to basically close out our discussion here, given all that you've said about the importance of these great books, how can you get the Tony Gills of the world? These are the people who look at the great books and try to connect it with the Christianity and say, oh, the Book of Jonah, Herman Melville, hey, they both deal with whales. That's the kind of level I'm operating on. How do you get people like me to become more engaged with these books?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. I mean, I would say two very practical ideas to bear in mind if you're interested in trying to start on this journey. One is to start small. If you have the dream of running a marathon, but right now you're a couch potato, you don't just get up off the couch one day and you say, hey, I'm going to go run a marathon, and run out the door and try to run 26.2 miles. And by the way, I should say that the 26.2 miles of the marathon, that's a reference to the great books, Herodotus' History and the Battle of Marathon.
Yeah.
Distance between Marathon and Athens. So it's still around. It's still influencing us, but that's a digression. Okay, so you start small. If you don't sit down to, let's say if you're interested in economics, you're a political scientist, Tony, so you're familiar with the world of political science, but you're not going to sit down and open up War and Peace and try to read it front to back.
Mm-hmm.
That would be suicidal in terms of your motivation to try to engage with this. Now, if you want to run a marathon but you're a couch potato, the first thing you do is you get up and you walk a mile. All right, so you start small. Take something that's manageable, something that you say, I'm going to set aside 30 minutes this week to try to get into this. And with that 30 minutes, you select something small and manageable. It could be an essay that's a few pages long by an author like Francis Bacon. Or it could be a one-page or a one-column meditation on the idea of self-control by the Stoic philosopher Epictetus. You know, that's the sort of thing that I think anybody could sit down, take a few minutes and read and take some time to reflect on. You don't try to bite off more than you can chew in the beginning. And then secondly, I would say, stick to your knitting as much as you can. Don't necessarily try to read something in a genre that is radically different from what you're familiar with. Start with what you are more familiar with and read something in that area. So in your case, Tony, if you're familiar with the world of political science, I would suggest taking a great work that's in that universe and trying to work your way through it. And maybe if it's something like the Communist Manifesto, okay, a work with which I heartily disagree on many levels, but it's hugely influential over the last couple of centuries. And as recently as maybe 20 or 30 years ago, something like half the world's population was ruled in the name of Karl Marx on one level or another. So this is a very significant work. It's a political work. You can sit down and read that. It's fairly short. You could read it in an hour, and you're going to be encountering ideas in that work that relate to stuff that you already know and things that you're already familiar with. And when you tackle the Communist Manifesto and you say, okay, I understand what Marx is saying. I think he's dead wrong on a lot of things. There might be one or two redeeming things in what Marx is saying, but let's then see where else that leads us. What other authors is Marx reacting to? Who's he in conversation with? Follow the thread. If you got something out of reading the Communist Manifesto, try to figure out which authors Marx is reacting to, what conversation he's furthering. And then pick another work from that same conversation and read it. It could be something in political economy. It could be a portion from Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. It could be some other economist or political thinker of the 18th or 19th century. And what C.S. Lewis said about the corpus of great books is once you get started in it, if you keep going, everything will eventually lead you to everything else. So start small and start with something that's relatively familiar to you, and you'll eventually work your way to the rest of the big pie.
Well, as somebody who has run two marathons and has done that by starting out by taking a few steps, I think that is extremely good advice. And I think it's advice that also leads us back to your website, The Western Tradition, where you give small bite-sized pieces of a variety of different works for people to start with, to think about, and to participate in on your blog. And so I'm going to once again strongly recommend to my listeners that they check out your blog, The Western Tradition, to maybe get a jump start on this and to see what's being written out there. And with that said, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion, Jason.
Thanks, Tony. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.